Six music.
BBC Radio. Six music documentaries.
And welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is where we meet some of the most influential figures in music and take a look at the pivotal first moments that made them who they are today. There aren't many people who can claim responsibility for as many titles, hits, or heart-pumping musical moments as my guest this week. As bassist with the House Martins, he was part of one of the UK's defining indie bands. As one of Beats International and Freak Power, he crossed over into pop, while he helped shape UK hip-hop under countless guises, including Pizza Man, Rockaway 3, and the Mighty Dubcats. And that's all before we start discussing his alter ego as the country's most beloved superstar DJ. My guest this week on The First Time is Norman Cook. Here, Norman talks about his childhood and formative musical loves, which were as diverse as his future career, the music which soundtracked his early romantic interludes, and his life-changing obsession with punk, especially The Clash. He also looks back on the formation of the House Martins and their social, political and fashion ethos and their uneasy relationship with success, as well as the roots of his career as a DJ and hip-hop producer, and of course, the massive international success of his most famous incarnation, Fatboy Slim. A success that continues to this day, with sold-out shows across the world, a recent slot at the Olympic closing ceremony, and his ongoing series of Big Beach boutique gigs, most recently a show at the Amex Stadium in Brighton, the home of his beloved Brighton & Hove FC, a film which was released in cinemas and is about to come out on DVD. And I start by asking Norman, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
The first time I was aware of music was probably singing in the car on long journeys with my family. Both my parents liked to sing, and so we would sing. We probably didn't have a radio in the car in those days, that's what it was. But we would sing, and we would sing harmonies. And I really enjoyed the kind of collective noise that you made in a car. And it probably, there was a lot of Peter, Paul and Mary going on.
That's what you get for loving me. That's what you get for loving me. Everything you had is gone, as you can see.
That's then what you get for recorded music. Would probably be, actually, I Can't Let Maggie Go, The Honey Bus, which was my dad's favourite tune.
Was it quite a musical family that you came from?
My family was musical to the amount that they enjoyed singing. There's no kind of history of sort of showbiz or anything. They were more into amateur dramatics. I wouldn't say that they had a really hugely great taste in music. Basically, my staple diet was Peter, Paul and Mary rather than Bob Dylan. Sort of sanitised versions thereof. There was an awful lot of Kenny Ball and his jazz men going on.
Nice.
Again, trad jazz light. A healthy amount of Beatles, which is good. And also a generous dose of the Carpenters. So it's quite middle of the road. There was, and I didn't have a big older brother or sister who was into Motown or... So I had to kind of forge my own kind of musical identity out of Kenny Ball and his jazz men. Oh, Herb Albert and his Tijuana Brass.
Brilliant, I love Herb Albert.
There was quite a lot of bossa nova went on in my family, actually, which might explain some of my later Latin influence.
But Honeybus was the one, you remember him?
Honeybus was the one I can just remember my dad singing in a very middle-of-the-road style. He had an album called Nice and Easy, which is when easy listening was like this new thing. I can't let Maggie go.
She makes me laugh, she makes me cry. With a twinkle of her eye, she flies like a bird in the sky. She flies like a bird, and I wish that she was mine.
What about the first record that was yours, that you owned, the first single, first piece of music that belonged to you?
First record I owned was Devil Gate Drive by Susie Quattro, which, it was in the days where everybody had one record, so when you went to a party, everyone brought their one record, and it was who's got played the most. And I remember one just an early teenage party, we'd have to look up what year it was, but I probably would have been about 12, 13, and... Yeah, Devil Gate Drive beat Tiger Feet by Mud. because we thought it was cooler. It probably got played 20 times rather than the 17 times that Tiger Feet got played.
What was it about Susie Quattro? Because she was quite a striking figure, was she not?
Yeah, she was. I mean, for me in those days, she was kind of cutting-edge, leather-clad rock chick personified. She was, you know, the wilder side of life. Yeah, she wore leather jackets. She didn't take no shizzle from no one. And, yeah, she rocked out in Devil Gate Drive. And she played bass as well.
About the time that you started to think, I'd like to do that, whatever that is that they're doing, making
what,
that
to
noise.
Susie Quattro?
Not specifically do it to Susie Quattro. More like, whatever that noise is I'm hearing, I would like to be creating that.
I would love to say yes. Sadly, it was more to do with the Osmonds. There was, around the time of Crazy Horses...
Good tune again.
They, yeah, it's, which is still... It's, I've heard it the other day and it still holds up. Around the time of Crazy Horses, the Osmonds came over for a British tour, and Donny had a piano with light bulbs all around it that lit up when he played the piano, and he had a leather jacket with his name in studs on the back. And I think that was the point where I thought, that's what I want to do for a living. That's kind of, that looks like a cool thing to do. So, yeah, musically, I would probably veer more towards Susie Quattro, but in terms of that's what I want to do for the rest of my life, it was actually Donny Osmond. Ashamed to say, but that was my inspiration.
And what about...
But Donny, when he was rocking out...
Oh, yeah.
And also, he had a piano, and he had this little machine that went...
Okay,
which
so
I think kind of sort of predates some of the noises that I've made on my tunes subsequently.
It's almost like a primitive 303.
It was a stylophone or something, I think. But, yeah, it was a very primitive 303.
Albums then, what was the first album? Because that's kind of when you start to really get establish your relationship with an artist, when you've got a whole long player.
That's a big investment, because an album in those days was, that would have been about 2-3 months pocket money. So you have to forego all sweets and other pleasures for 2 or 3 months to save up. My first one was Black and Blue by the Rolling Stones on cassette.
Nice.
which is a new format in those days. That was the cool thing, and I think it was slightly cheaper. And the pivotal song was Fool to Cry, which I think probably was my first introduction to the concept of production.
What do you mean?
Because it starts with a Rhodes piano. We'll hopefully hear it in a sec. It starts with a Rhodes piano, which has been affected, which I just thought was the most warm, sexy-sounding thing I'd ever heard. And years later, when I started making music, I'd suddenly think, how does he make that noise? And then when I first started going in recording studios, I actually remember playing it to someone saying, how do you make that noise? And they said, well, you take a Fender Rhodes, and then you put it through a chorus, like a stereo chorus, and it has that kind of spongy, warm, wow kind of thing. And I think that's the first time I was thinking that music wasn't just people playing their instruments. There was this thing called production, which affected how the music, you know, and then you get into reverb and, you know, delay and everything, which subsequently became my career. So, yeah, that would have been a pivotal record for me, and first time I thought, how do they make those sounds?
I've been working all night long. I put my daughter on my knee, and she said, Daddy, what's wrong? She whispered in my ear so sweet. You know what she said?
Other key tracks. We're going to talk about whether we're going to do this or not, but let's go there.
Well, the thing is, I think music is always the soundtrack to your life. And when people, if someone complains that I haven't got a head for figures or remembering footballers' names or anything, when it comes to music, I have got a photographic memory, and it is the soundtrack of my life. So I remember what was playing when I've met every single girlfriend I've ever had. So, if you want to do first snog, first shag, stuff like that, then bring it on.
Okay,
baby.
Right. Right, first snog, I want locations, I want circumstances, and I want music.
Donata School Disco, Taylor Fox, that's the girl, not the artist.
That's a great name.
She was an American girl who wore glasses, which made my first snog somewhat complicated because I didn't know where to put the nose and glasses arrangement. And it was Tina Charles, I Love to Love.
That's a good song to kiss to.
It was a good song to kiss to, but I wanted to love and she wanted to dance. So it was sort of role reversal from the song, because I just wanted to snog. I was on a roll. I don't think it was her first, it was my first. I was sort of carry on snogging, she wanted to dance.
When did you start playing instruments yourself? Was the bass your first instrument?
No, I started as a drummer.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, the best people are drummers.
only for about 4 gigs, I think. I wasn't the world's best, but you didn't have to be. This was in punk days, so. And then I was lead singer for a bit, and then I was guitarist. But my first professional gig was on bass, was the House Martins. But I'd previously been the guitarist in Paul's old band, the Stomping Pom Frogs, which mutated into the House Martins, but then when I rejoined, I had to learn the bass.
But before that, it was a punk. You got into the punk thing.
Yeah.
Who were your big punk obsessions?
The Clash. The Clash.
That was a quick answer.
They were still the last gang in town, and they had the swagger, they had the fashions, they had the politics, they had the tunes. Yeah, no, for me, that epitomised everything that was exciting, romantic and wholesome about punk rock. Not, you know, sort of nihilistic gobbing and flirting with Nazi armbands. Like, they had their politics down pat, they had their look, they had their stance. Every time I ever play bass guitar, I always thought I was Paul Simonon.
Is that where you have the bass so low?
Yeah, I always, every bass, it's like, see how far the guitar got to go down. I can't actually play it Ramones style where it's by your knees, but I would have it about Paul Simonon height. And I always just feel a little bit of Paul Simonon spirit in me every time I play the bass.
What's the Clash song we should play?
Ooh, Safe European Home. I remember the first time I heard that album, I think it was first track, side one, and I was just like, oh my God, that is fantastic.
We haven't done first gig. What was the first gig that you went to?
First gig I went to was Queen.
Yes.
In Hyde Park. I looked it up. 1976? Yeah, so I would have been 13. No idea how my parents allowed my 17-year-old brother to take a 13-year-old all the way up to London to go to a free gig in Hyde Park. But we did.
What do you remember from it?
I remember...
Because that's the height of their pomp, isn't it? That really is. That's,
I remember, well, again, in terms of stagecraft, I remember that was probably the moment when I thought, right, you can do something with this stagecraft thing. They started with a whole load of dry ice, which I'd never seen in real life before. And in the days when it really was dry ice and it would hug the ground because it was heavier than air. So they poured out all this dry ice and then they played the taped operatic bit from Bohemian Rhapsody.
Nice.
Because obviously they couldn't do it live. And we were all like thinking, oh, what's going to happen? The smoke's building out. And they get to the big Wayne's World moment. And at that point, Freddie Mercury just on some kind of trampoline appears out of the dry ice and they go into dan, 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 dan. And I think I might have had a little kind of semi-orgasm. and this is kind of me being aware of bands but not aware of punk rock, probably by only a couple of months. So that was that was my kind of brief flirtation with sort of pomp rock, and then punk rock quickly sort of took over.
So your first gig that you played...
My first gig that I played was at Redlands Youth Centre in Reigate, and it was supporting The Cure.
Supporting The Cure?
In a band called Disc Attack. A Disc Attack. So this is me on drums. It was really exciting. It was my first time playing on stage. I think we only played about sort of five or six songs quite quickly. It was it's a bit like your first sex. It's over quite quickly and probably not the best you ever did, but it was still very exciting and memorable nonetheless.
Did you feel comfortable on stage? Did you feel like... Because, I mean, there's the desire to get up and do something in front of an audience, but the reality of it is very different.
I was totally comfortable with the whole kind of showy-offy, I'm going to be on stage, I'm hanging around in the dressing room, there's chicks there kind of thing. I think I was probably felt a little bit held back the fact I was on drums.
Right.
I think that was why I only lasted about three or four gigs on drums. Yeah, because our lead singer was quite shy, and I was like, you can't have a shy bloke and do lead vocals. So, yeah, I probably felt a little bit inhibited, a bit like Keith Moon on the drums. I kind of wanted to be the front man, so I was showing off at the back.
So how did your love of punk rock mutate into working with Paul Heaton. And what was your first meeting like, you two?
It was at a pub in Nutfield, the station in Nutfield, and his band was supporting my band. I was singing in my band, but I wasn't a very good singer. And he, yeah, I just thought he was a fantastic front man. And I was mates with the drummer, which is why they were supporting us. And we just kind of, we quit our respective bands and started one together. He was wearing fireman's trousers.
What?
I don't know. Paul still, to this day, does tons of things that no one quite understands what the motivation was or what point he was trying to make. But yeah, he kind of, anyone was trying to be fashionable and new wave, and he just came with rubber fireman's trousers on. They weren't flattering or fashionable. They were just a Heaton statement.
Was there that real community spirit in the House Martins? Did it feel like you mentioned the Clash had that gang thing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
we based
a lot of our idealism on the Clash, and one was that, yeah, we were a gang. We dressed, where was a dress code. There were certain things that weren't allowed.
What wasn't allowed?
Hats. I used to wear those kind of sort of French fisherman's hats. And when I joined the band, they meant there's no hats in this band. There was no jeans originally.
Really?
No, it was, we were kind of, so when we first started, it was very anti-fashion. So yeah, basically you couldn't wear anything fashionable. And yeah, and we would have band meetings about, you know, what's our stance on this and what's our stance on that. And we were against hotels at the beginning. The first proper major tour we did, we stayed at fans' houses. A, to save money, but B, because we thought we didn't feel comfortable in hotels. We thought that was like living some kind of rock star dream. And if we fell into that kind of mindset, then next thing we know, we'd just be kind of egotistical, drug-addled lunatics. So, we kept each other firmly down to earth. A band that plays football together, plays gigs together, you know. Yeah, it was very, we were, yeah, fiercely competitive, fiercely loyal, and like you said, yeah, you know, we would play football together in the afternoon and have that same kind of team mentality on stage.
We've got to talk about Happy Hour just because it was such a remarkable success and such a different sounding single to anything that was kind of around the charts at the time, and you sort of look back and there was kind of, it does really stand alone, still sounds fantastic. Did you, for a band with these very strict rules and this code, how did fame and Top of the Pops suit you?
We really liked the Top of the Pops bit because we'd all grown up watching Top of the Pops, and there was a real moment when we first did Top of the Pops, we were just looking at each other going, this is it, we are now living the dream. But but the fame bit of it we weren't so fond of, and Paul especially was really, as soon as, yeah, at this point we were still, you know, denying hotels. And I remember we did the Tube and they put us up in a hotel, and Paul's like, I don't know, hang around in hotels with all these rich people. And yeah, we kind of went even more staunchly anti-fame. Yeah, I was talking to Paul the other day about the first tour we did when we were like a hit, and we all only had like one pair of trousers with us. We'd been playing football in the afternoon, and they would have like kind of mud and the chalk lines from the football pitch, and let's do your washing for you, boys. We're like, no, we're all right. So we were kind of grubby urchins, and I think Paul's complete anti-fame stance set me up well for later life. Because I've always never taken it that seriously, though I've since, you know, enjoyed some of the luxuries of it and enjoyed some of the ego side of it. I can always hear Paul's voice going, you know, we don't act like that. He's always there keeping me in check.
What a good place to be. Don't believe it. Trees.
where they open all the wallets and they close all the minds and they love to buy you all a drink. And as we ask all the questions, and you take all your clothes up and back to the kitchen sink.
You're listening to The First Time here on Six Music with me, Matt Everett, and that was Happy Hour by The House Martins, the band's first hit from 1986, featuring on bass my guest this week, Norman Cook.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Celebrate you, baby. I have to praise you like I
I'm Matt Everett. Welcome back to The First Time here on Six Music with my guest, Norman Cook, producer, DJ, big beat hero and Brightonian figurehead, talking us through the music that's defined his life. And that was, of course, Praise You from Fatboy Slim's 1997 album, You've Come a Long Way, Baby. When did you first get into hip-hop?
I first got into hip-hop going to see The Clash and then being supported by Grandmaster Flash.
Oh, so it goes back to that, okay.
Yeah. But I was already a DJ, but it was like, what the hell is he doing with the records? And how's he making that noise? And why is it making me dance so much? So, Adventures of Grandmaster Flash and the Wheels of Steel was a real life changing record for me.
You see, one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Five, five, Freddy told me everybody slide. DJ is spinning, I said, my. Flash is cool, Francois,
Sipa,
Flash ain't no dude.
You say one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
I've based most of my career on it ever since. The idea of chopping up songs and making other tunes out of them. It was probably as big an influence as punk in terms of being, I don't know, it kind of had its own language and its own fashion and its own culture, which I suppose I'm trying to remember how old I was. This is when I was just starting, when I was old enough to DJ in clubs. So until then I'd been kind of like party DJ, and then I did weddings, and when I moved down to Brighton when I was 18, I could DJ in nightclubs, and it was around the year that Planet Rock came out, and that record as well just sort of changed my life. It's like, what is this weird abuse of electronic instruments, and why do I like it so much?
Party people, then you'll get funky. Suicide and force, then you'll get funky. The Zulu Nation, then you'll get funky. Yeah, just hit me. Just taste the funk and hit me. Just get on down and hit me. Man, my just getting so funky now, hit me. Yeah, just hit me.
It's time to chase your dreams. How about the seats? Make your body sway. Socialize. Get down. Let your soul.
What was your first post House Martins electronic incarnation then? What was the first track? The
first thing I did, which was about 3 weeks after I moved back to Brighton and thought, right, that was a lovely dream, what am I going to do next?
As quick as that?
Yeah. Was a remix of I Know You Got Soul by Eric B and Rakim. Record company plugger who I'd been working with, the House Martins, who knew me as a club DJ. He just said, "Oh, what, we've got the rights to I Know You Got Soul. How can we remix it? What could we do?" And I went, "Well, there's an acapella on the other side. You can spin it over anything." And I just did a little demo of mixing it with the Jackson 5. I Want You Back, and sent him that and said, "That's what you could do." And he said, "Well, do you want to go and do it like in the studio?" So I did, and so literally 3 weeks after the House Martins, I had this new career as a remixer, and it got some number three in the charts.
It's pretty punk, that, actually, isn't it? The ethos of just going in and doing it with a vague idea of how you want it to sound and not that much expertise, I guess.
I think that was one of the attractions of sample paste for music. It really was like in Sniffing Glue, it said, here's a guitar, here's a three chords, now go and start a band. Now it's, here's your record collection, here's a sampler, now make a dance record.
There have been all these different names that you have gone under all throughout your career, and the Guinness record for most top 40 hits under the most names, which I believe you still hold. Can you name them all? Go on, try.
All right. Would have been the House Martins, Rockaway 3, Double Trouble, Mighty Dove Cats, Freak Power, Norman Cook featuring.
Just one more word.
Fatboy Slim. That's seven. There's one more. No, it's the answer to the question. I can't name them all. Beats International.
Beats International.
Ah.
Is it a desire to be kind of part of the music making process, but not actually have your name? Is it trying to sort of protect a little bit of yourself, anonymity?
There was a little bit of hiding behind different names, so no one really knew who I was. And in those days, it was more about having more than one record out at once.
So it was just practical as having more than one hit.
And it was also about being signed to one label and not wanting to put everything out on that one label. You see, it was fun in those. It was also quite fun because it meant I could put out sort of acid jazz records as Freak Power, and then put out a pure house record with no preconceptions of like, oh, it's that bloke trying to do that. And you only got outed if it was really successful.
Check this out.
Tell me about that first Fatboy Slim album. 1996, Better Living Through Chemistry.
Yeah, well, the first thing about it was it wasn't really an album. It was a sort of greatest hits so far. Because in those days, there was no precedent of dance albums that made any sense or sold any copies. But I think by the time we released Better Living Through Chemistry, I'd had 7 singles out as Fatboy Slim. But it had a sort of cohesion as an album and tapped into just a time of again, another sort of punk-like DIY revolution where people had got a bit bored of corporate handbag house music. And so we sort of ripped up the rule book and thought, well, let's have the energy of acid house but include the beats from hip hop and then the Beatles that I grew up with. There you are, that's the formula, kids. Now I go out and make a record.
You said that electronic music didn't sell albums, but then you released You've Come a Long Way, Baby, which became one of the first big crossover dance records.
Yeah,
in popular music, because it had the singles, but it also became this kind of world. It was an album you could listen to as a whole album.
And it was an album that was made, intended to be an album,
right,
rather than a collection of previous stuff I'd done. I think by then, The Prodigy had... I think The Prodigy would definitely get the medal for being the first.
Right.
When I was making that album, I was thinking of it more in terms of an album.
Was there a point when you can remember first thinking, when you were performing, this idea of the superstar DJ, of just like, okay, this is happening now. Hang on a minute, this is different.
I can remember the exact moment. It was at the Essential Festival in Stanmer Park in Brighton, where we had a Big Beat Boutique tent. And the Big Beat Boutique was our home club, held 200 people. It was rammed every Friday. Now, when we put everyone in a tent, which was like 1,000 people at this festival, we realised that if all the 200 people who came every other week at the boutique, if you put them all in the same room at the same time and you put me up on the decks, they start to go proper nuts. And Gary, my manager, said that was when he suddenly thought, oh God, this is like watching a band. This isn't like a DJ in the corner of a nightclub. This is somebody performing on stage who's controlling the crowd and making them react like a band.
Right about now, the Funk Soul Brother. Check it out now, the Funk Soul Brother. Right about now, the Funk Soul Brother. Check it out now, the Funk Soul Brother. Right about now, the Funk Soul Brother. Check it out now, the Funk Soul Brother. Right about now, the Funk Soul Brother. Right about now.
And then you've got tracks like Praise You and Right Here Right Now that crossed over into the States, and all of a sudden you've got MTV and you've got these amazing videos that you made, and you become DJ as proper superstar. You were the face of, like, you were the front man of band.
I would get to gigs and like the sound man would say, are you in Fatboy Slim?
Well,
to which my reply was always, no, do you want to be? But yeah, no, they get a lot of people, and I did gigs in America where I would play my DJ set and then they'd be waiting for Fatboy Slim, the band, to come on afterwards.
Seriously?
And they couldn't understand why I'd played Rockefeller Skank and Praise You when the band were going to come on and do it in a minute. Yeah, there was a little bit, but it wasn't intimidating. I quite enjoyed sort of the wind up of it all. And yeah, there were certain gigs we did in America where people were like, no DJs ever, you know, no DJs ever played this, the Hard Rock Cafe in Vegas before. They're like, where's your band? And I was like, this is just X. And I did, we did Red Rocks with the Chems, and Woodstock, and had tons of venues where they just said, we've never had a DJ play in this venue and fill it, and everyone go nuts before.
The first Big Beach Boutique was 2001, which has now become this quasi-annual, semi-annual event that you do. Can you remember staging the first one?
The first one was possibly the most exciting and rewarding gig of my life.
Wow.
To the point that, yeah, when I came off stage, we were, me and my manager just sat in the porter cabin and said, right, that's it, we've got to retire now. How are we ever going to top that? It really did feel that we had kind of achieved something historic, and we really didn't think it could be topped. We didn't think it could get any bigger than that. I think the reason that the first Big Beach Boutique was so exciting because it was the first time we'd pulled anything like that off. We've since done it sort of bigger and probably more professionally. But it was just the fact, everyone was so excited, just the fact that it was happening.
I've just got written down here, Al Green. When did you first hear Al Green? Because I know you have a lot of love for the Reverend.
When did I first hear Al Green? It was on a compilation, it was on a mixtape that Paul Heaton made me. And it was Shalala, make me happy. Yeah, like I said, Paul was a soul music fan when previously I'd only really listened to sort of punk and new wave. And he used to make me a load of, make me cassettes, which I've still got. As soon as I heard that, I was like, why is that the sweetest voice? Because you kind of heard Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder in the charts, but Al Green was sort of below my radar until then. And I still believe he's just got one of the sweetest voice in soul.
Because there's that thing when you start to sell records, you start to indulge, you're right, who do I want to work with? And you have worked with some fantastic people.
But not Al Green.
But not Al Green, no, he's
and
just...
And you know why.
You're just too much of a heathen is basically the point.
Yeah, he's the Reverend Al Green, and I am a godless sinner. And I think someone's told him that, because we've dropped a lot of hints with his management and everything, and he's never come back to us.
BPA on the BPA project, and more latterly on the Here Lies Love musical. is David Byrne.
Yeah.
Who, an enormously gifted musical theorist, mind, artist. How did you meet? How did you first meet? And how did you get involved with making music with each other?
I bumped into David Byrne just over the years, and he was one of those people that I loved so much that I couldn't help myself but go up and tell them. There's certain people that you love so much that you feel that you know them and that you are allowed to go up and go and talk to them. Some people you just go worship from afar. But no, I'd had chats with him, and he keeps his finger on the pulse of music, and it was all his idea to work together. He was writing a musical about the life of Imelda Marcos.
Obviously.
Didn't want to tell the shoe story, wanted it to be more about how she was spending all the government aid that should have been spent on the people. She was in Studio 54 hanging out with the Jaggers. And so he had this sort of vibe about where would she be hanging out if she was doing it now, and he was thinking Manumission in Ibiza. Thought, who's the resident of Manumission in Ibiza? Fatboy Slim. Oh, I've met him a few times, and he seems, you know, and so yeah, and so he just rang me up. And to be honest, if anybody else in the world had phoned up and said, "Do you want to co-write a musical about the life of Imelda Marcos?" I would have gone, not really me. But as it's David Byrne, you don't say no, and you know that it's going to work out.
First time that you thought your lifestyle maybe was getting in the way of your music, and you thought you might do something about it, because you've been quite open talking about the fact you've cleaned up. Was there a point when you thought, okay?
No, there never was a time when I thought my lifestyle was getting in the way of my professional career. There was times when my reasons for quitting were more to do with my family and my health. Had it got in the way of my career, I maybe would have stopped or slowed down earlier on. But the reason I got away with it for so long was being a DJ and making, you know, abstract druggy music is not necessarily prohibitive to living the life. No, it wasn't a professional thing. It was, like I said, it's mainly about my health and my family.
It's just about to come out is the DVD of The Big Beach Bootique, B-O-O.
Do you see what we did there?
At your beloved Brighton & Hove Albion Football Club. Your first full film released in cinemas worldwide. What was it about? Because the show was one of the biggest productions you've ever done. It was huge, wasn't it?
Yeah. The last time we filmed a show was Big Beach 2, which was the one where the world and his wife turned up, and that really was Norm Stock. That was like 250,000 people, and we were so glad that we'd happened to film that gig, because A, no one would have believed us about what it looked like, but B, that was my calling card to then go and do it in Rio and Bondi Beach, and it opened a whole new career for me internationally. And we just felt that this one was going to be another sort of pivotal gig in terms of, if you watch the Big Beach 2 DVD, there's an awful lot of crowd and not much show. We had
little tiny figure in the distance.
Yeah, we had a screen with some very rudimentary visuals that weren't in sync with the music. And we had one searchlight that when it got light, sort of scanned around the sky. But there was no production. So our show now is evolved, and technology and everything has allowed us to be completely audiovisual. So we wanted, you know, just a document of what the show now looks like. And again, it's a sort of a calling card of this is what we can do if you give us the budget. When we had a whole football stadium to play with and a week to build it, it's like, let's see what we could do if we were given the time and the money.
Finally, you get to choose the last song of the show as well.
It would have to be, well, continuing on the theme of the soundtrack of your life, mm-hmm. It would have to be the tune that was playing when I first met my wife. No, Music Sounds Better With You by Stardust was the soundtrack to this summer in Ibiza, and specifically the night that I met Zoe. And so, yeah, so this is the music that was playing when I first met my wife.
Thank you very much. It's good to speak to you.
Hello, this is a shorter version of a weekly new music playlist titled Handpicked by Six Music, one of a big collection of music playlists you can now download and subscribe to in the BBC Sounds app. To find the full version, just search Handpicked and check out some of the other playlists tailored for whatever music you need or mood you're in.